طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestine homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we feature Mazen Kumsia, who teaches and does research at Bethlehem University and Birzeit University in the occupied West Bank of Palestine. He is the founder and director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History and Institute for Biodiversity Research at Bethlehem University. He previously served on the faculties of the University of Tennessee, Duke University, and Yale University. He has published over 130 scientific papers on topics ranging from biodiversity to cancer. He has also published hundreds of articles and several books. Mazen is a world-class scientist, but is best known to us as a fearless organizer and advocate for Palestinian rights. Here is Mazen Kumsia, recently speaking at the Community Church of Boston.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I know there's been a lot of talks and a lot of events and a lot of demonstrations and in San Francisco and Boston and New York and Washington, D.C., everywhere around the world. So people are very busy. I hope you can see my screen here. I'm not going to give a formal presentation, but I do want to skip through some slides and then say a few words about what I think is happening globally and why things are heating up soon, and that this genocide, you know, I'll tell you the bottom line. The bottom line is if this genocide does not stop very, very soon, we will be down the road of a global war, a regional war, that leads to global war, and that then there will be genocides around the world. This is my bottom line, basically. But that we can make a difference in stopping it. And so this is my message to you, and I hope I'll bring the arguments forward to explain to you why I think so. Now, you know, the problem here is very clear to you all from previous talks. You've heard from other people, not just me, that there was an attempt to take a country that's multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, and even multilingual country and make it a Jewish state. This attempt to transform a Palestine into a racist Jewish state called Israel took decades in the making and took support of a lot of people. And I'm talking about support of Western governments, which is still there, support of some Arab governments, which are still there, support of mass media that is controlled by the Zionist lobbies that is still there, that makes it possible to do this. And I could go on and on, but my point here is not a history lesson. As you know, this displacement settler colonialism is not unique to Palestine. It happened before, for example, in the U.S. when it was created and the Native Americans were left in reservations. This settler colonialism is, however, pretty aggressive, and it is happening in the 20th century and 21st century when most settler colonialisms were not there. Before October 7 and what transpired afterwards, over 100,000 Palestinians have been killed. For example, in 2021, 90 children, 2022, more than 120 children, 2023 to 7 October, 39 children, and so on. This system that existed before, the genocide that existed before, is now kind of ignored and passed over. And this is kind of sad situation. But for example, yesterday we commemorated Rachel Corey's anniversary of killing of Rachel Corey, a friend of ours, who was killed by a bulldozer in Rafah. And you hear now a lot about Rafah. Rachel Corey was bulldozed to death in Rafah. Many people were killed in Rafah in 2003, 2004, and beyond. This is over 20 years ago. So, and Rachel Corey and other foreigners were then also killed, which is unusual for Israel not to pay attention to the fact that they are foreigners. At the time I'm talking about, now they don't care. They kill foreigners with no, I mean, there are many American citizens who happen to be Palestinians who were living in Gaza, and they are either killed or injured. The situation, you know, we can look at it from a perspective of history as not very unique, if you want, but there's some uniqueness to this genocide. You know, sorry. This is the Gaza Strip, by the way, 2.3, 2.4 million people. It's from which the word Gauz comes from, is Gaza. And the Gaza Strip is populated mostly with children. Over half the population is children. The idea of what to do with the Gaza Strip started to develop long before even 1967 war. But in 1967, Israel was faced with this population that is living in the Gaza Strip. Two-thirds of it are refugees or displaced people that Israel occupied and even built settlements in the Gaza Strip. You know, from the beginning, from 1948 onward, the biggest obstacle to achieving the Zionist project, of course, of colonizing Palestine, make it a Jewish state, has been the Palestinians. So what to do with the Palestinians? And, you know, Rafael Itan, for example, said, well, when we settle the land, these cockroaches will run around like drugged cockroaches in a bottle. Well, this was the mild version of the plan for Palestine. After this, developed stronger ideas, right-wing government ideas of genocide and of ethnic cleansing, even more than what was done in 1948. Today, by the way, 15 million Palestinians live in the world. 8 million of us are refugees or displaced people. So it is no longer the plan of the Israeli Zionist project to contain the remaining Palestinians in enclaves and leave them there, enclaves like Bethlehem, Nablus, Gaza Strip, etc. The ideas developed very early on in the 1980s and certainly in the 1990s among Likud and other right-wing parties in Israel that we cannot manage this population. The left-wing Zionist parties, of course, like Labor and Rabin and Peres, thought they could do like what South Africa did under apartheid, keeping Bantustans, ghettos for the Palestinians. So Rabin and Peres' plan, which was implemented via the Oslo Accords, at least for a few years, was to squeeze the Palestinians into those people, warehouses, unwanted, and have them scurry around like drugged cockroaches in a bottle, as Rafael Eitan said. Well, things changed dramatically in the late 1980s and early 1990s. What changed? Well, the Russian Empire, Soviet Empire, collapsed basically in 1989, I believe. And so it was not possible to play these chess games with two empires duking it out on other people's expenses, the American Empire and the Soviet Empire. The second thing that happened is as the Soviet Empire collapsed, there was a lot of Russian Jews living in Russia, who suddenly found that the doors were open for them to do two things. One is, sorry, I have a cold and it's kind of tough, but so I'll try to make my talk shorter. But two things happened. One is these Russian Jews who were Zionists by sympathies to the Israeli project, they suddenly had access to a lot of resources, you know, and they developed, many of them developed to become billionaires, a Russian class of oligarchs. And of course, Israel welcomed them, having destroyed the banking system in Switzerland, Israeli banking systems were open to the Russian mafia and those Russians, and the state, not just within Russia itself, but all the countries that were previously part of the Soviet Union, like Ukraine and Moldova and others, suddenly had the ability to have people become very wealthy, migrate to Israel, deposit their money in Israeli banks, avoid taxation, and so that was an important component of a power of a right-wing fascist mafia that grew in Israel in the 1990s. And their poster boy was none other than Netanyahu himself, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose family is Polish. His father changed the name of the family from Malinowski or something to Netanyahu to sound more Israeli or more Jewish. But Netanyahu's rise to power in the 1990s was associated also with ties to the Russian mafia and the Russian oligarchs, and that's where they got most of their money. And of course, they got money. Likud also got hundreds of millions of dollars from people like Edelson, an American billionaire, made a lot of his money from casinos that he ran in Las Vegas and around the world. So they donated lots of money to the right-wing Likud party. The more left-wing Zionists like Rabin and Peres were left short-changed, if you want. They had people like Saban, Chaim Saban, an American very rich guy also, I think he's also like a multi-billionaire, who donated to the Labor Party in Israel in the 1990s. But as the Likud gained more and more power in the 1990s and the rhetoric became more and more militant, causing actually one person to follow on their recommendations and assassinate Yitzhak Rabin, the political rival for Netanyahu. And this actually, instead of the government punishing the Likudniks, if you want, the government actually turned Likudnik, and Rabin's successor, Shimon Peres, actually made right-wing decisions and denied Palestinians access to holy sites and increased settlement activities, all of this stuff, to try and placate the right wing, if you want, instead of punishing them for killing his partner. And this all happened in the mid-1990s. And when elections came, this didn't help him, didn't help Peres or his party. So the Likud won a landslide, basically victory, was able to form a government, a very right-wing government, and proceed to increase settlement activities in the West Bank. So who are these people, the Likud and the right-wing in Israel, and what's their plans? And I think it's important to understand the context of what's happening in Gaza today and in the West Bank also, where I live, where I speak to you from Bethlehem, to understand the context. This is Prime Minister Netanyahu, well before October 7, 2023, explaining about Israel and its plans. He says Israel is an economic superpower, Israel is a military superpower, Israel can do what it wants, and it's already normalizing. He said we control America, and Israel will normalize with these Arab countries like United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, etc. And the idea that he presented is that Israel will create an alternative path from Asia to Europe that bypasses the new Silk Road, the Belt and Road Initiative that China built from Asia to Europe and spent some $6 trillion on it. He says we don't have to spend that much, but we do not have a shortage of money. There's, Israel is one of the richest countries on earth and controls much of the wealth of the Middle East, be it Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, all of this stuff. So with or without normalization, the idea was to use this money from Saudi Arabia, from United Arab Emirates, that most of them are deposited in banks affiliated with the Zionists, and whether in the United States or New York or whether it's in Tel Aviv. And this money will build the railroad and other tracks across the Middle East that connects Asia with Europe. Not only that, Gaza has something along the coasts of Gaza, gas fields that contain hundreds of trillions, basically, of cubic feet of natural gas. And these gas fields are estimated to be worth some $200 billion, with a B, $200,000 million. Obviously, Israel wants these gas fields, and they've already began using them even before this October war, so to speak, which is not a war, really, is more of a genocide of the people of Gaza. If you look on the map on the right, on the left, the fishing area that Gaza people are allowed is shown in bluish color, shown where here. Here's the fishing area that's allowed. And why is this fishing area that's allowed there like that? is not to be close to the Gaza Marine or other fishing areas. The map on the right shows the network of gas pipelines that are now already in the Mediterranean. You can add to them a new gas pipeline from Marine B and from the Gaza gas fields to Europe, which is now replacing Russian gas, if you want. To go back to the issue of Russia, by the way, because also most people don't understand what's going on in Russia. There's elections going on in Russia now, and Putin is likely to win with a landslide, probably. There are three other candidates, including communist person. But anyways, Russia recovered from the collapse of the Soviet Union and tried to stop the U.S. expanding NATO into, in fact, the collapse of the Soviet Union, reunification of Germany, were supposed to be conditional on NATO not expanding. But of course, NATO expanded to several countries nearby, and they were going to expand into Ukraine, which is like the largest country in Eastern Europe that borders Russia, and also has like 25% of its population are Russian-speaking people. So anyway, Russia in the 2000, around 2004, 2005 and beyond, recovered from this collapse of the Soviet Union and started to build its economy and its relationship with countries like China and other countries, and also Ukraine was a very close ally of Russia. Then the U.S., of course, intervened and toppled the pro-Russian president of Ukraine and installed this. Excuse me, let me just turn off. So the situation there is related in some sense because Russian political elites, including Putin and others, were very unhappy about Israeli close ties with Washington and its being servient to the U.S., and also that the oligarchs had run off from Russia with billions of Russian. Most of the natural resources in Russia were destroyed by these oligarchs who got them under great deals with the old, Gorbachev and the earlier government. So they would buy a mine, for example, for a few thousand dollars, and then, of course, destroy its situation and sell its natural resources and not employ Russians in there. Now, these people that are, again, like Netanyahu, like Yoav Gallant, many of these Israeli elites who are funded and supported by a lot of Russian oligarchs and American oligarchs and others, were genocidal in terms of their thoughts about the Palestinians. And you've seen these quotes, for example, from some of these people. They will destroy, they will annihilate, they will wipe out Gaza. Itzhak Herzog, for example, said, there are no civilians in Gaza, and they should kill everybody. The Israeli defense minister said, deny them food, water, electricity. We're denying them everything because we're dealing with human animals, not humans. And this has obviously got translated onto ground actions like you see here. And the killings that kept increasing, now it's over 31,000. And then the ethnic cleansing moving the population south towards Rafah. And, what Israel was planning, and this was clear from their own statements and their own rhetoric before October 7, by the way, and after October 7, is that they wanted to to destroy Gaza and clean it out, not keep it as an enclave like what Rabin and Peres would have wanted, enclave for the Palestinians or reservation for the Palestinians, but actually genocide and ethnic cleansing. You know, you give them a choice, either be killed or move to the Sinai. This was the plan. It was very well articulated and very well presented to the Israeli war cabinet also, and even before to the Israeli government. Now, these plans could have been executed within a few weeks or 2 or 3 weeks. Not, we are now in the 6th month of this. Except for one thing, the reason they didn't succeed in executing them within a few weeks is because the Palestinian resistance was very, very strong, stronger than even the Israeli military and the American CIA and everybody had predicted. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, were basically targeting Israeli tanks and picking them like ducks in a row, you know, they are just shooting them. Over 1,100, you know, vehicles, tanks, most of them tanks, some are armored personnel carriers and bulldozers were targeting with these, you know, well-structured anti-tank missiles called Yassin 105, which really amazing that you know, for cost of one of these things of a couple of $100 or $100, you're destroying a tank that's worth like $60 million. And of course, Israeli soldiers and Israeli mercenaries were killed in the process. You know, when I say mercenaries, there were mercenaries from the U.S., including Israeli military special forces in Gaza, from France, from Italy, from many, many countries, Belgium, Australia, India even. These are people who joined the Israelis in the assault on the Gaza Strip. So this was a remarkable ability to persist for almost 6 months now, with all these militaries combined. You know, Israel, of course, funded by the U.S., supported by the U.S. The U.S. gave Israel, you know, over $1 billion worth of bombs just in the past 6 months. To bomb Gaza. And so they bomb Gaza, but they are not bombing the resistance. They're bombing civilian places. And 70%, as you heard, of the residential buildings in Gaza were targeted. So Israel leveled Gaza, as they said they would, as I believe them when they say these things, as I said. So this is a picture on the lower left-hand corner of President Biden shaking hands with U.S. Servicemen who served in Gaza or went to Gaza. The State Department pulled this picture from their website after they realized its ramification if the American public knew that Americans were serving inside Gaza in military combat things. But anyway, the U.S. also supports these bombs, those F-35s, F-15s, F-16 airplanes, etc. The U.S. also knows very well what Israel intended to do in terms of genocide and ethnic cleansing. In fact, you know, New York Times, for example, is not a Palestinian-friendly newspaper, as you know, is owned by Zionists. But but even in the New York Times, it says that Israeli leaders believed mass civilian casualties were an acceptable price in the military campaign. And in conversations with American counterparts, Israeli officials referred to how the United States and other allied powers resorted to devastating bombing in Germany and Japan during World War II. including the dropping of two atomic bombs, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the largest terrorist action done historically, by the way, single bombings done so far. In fact, there were Israeli cabinet ministers who said we should just drop nuclear bombs on Gaza and get it over with. These are just parts of the names of the 31,560 Palestinian civilians who were killed so far. Actually, there's about 7,000 or 8,000 more who are missing under the rubble. They don't count them as dead yet because they don't know for sure what happened to them. But we're talking then, if you add those, about 38,000 in total Palestinian civilians killed. This is an average, if you divide it by the days since October 7, that would be about 120 to 150 Palestinian civilians killed daily. Half of them are children, 70% are actually children and women. For example, the Hassuna family, here you can see on the right side, they enlarged it. From age 1 year to age 15 years, all these people are dead. Israeli commanders and soldiers are not shy about proudly admitting that they are killing children, etc. So this is the kind of scenes that we see, horrific scenes that are unbelievable. And there's a lot of videos, and I won't go through this because I'm also in a bad mood now already. But these are people. Each one of those numbers, when I say 38,000 people, each one is a person, is a number. This is a, you know, for example, the violinist who was killed. This girl, Sana Al-Farra, was killed. You know, this girl and her brother were killed. Her younger brother survived. This guy was killed with his family. This medical doctor was killed. You know, each one of them, you know, this is Bisan Halasa. Of course, they have names, they have dreams, they have, you know, they have memories. I mean, this woman who was killed also is... she did an interview a few days before she was killed. She said, I'm older than the state of Israel that's attacking us. And then she proceeded to tell them about the cultural heritage of the village she comes from, which happens to be one of the areas that Israel took over and changed into a kibbutz near Gaza. There are 17,000 orphans in Gaza now. New orphans, basically. Luckily, I should say not luckily, but, you know, the killing of whole families means this number could have been higher if it was selective killing, but they were killing whole families, father, mother, children, grandparents, etc. So these orphans, how are they going to live in Gaza and how are they going to survive is something we need to talk about. There was an attack on the hospitals, which you heard about, and, you know, and Israel seems to get away with just about everything. They attacked the first hospital, and then when some people raised their eyebrows and started complaining, Israel said, well, it was an errant missile from Palestinians that attacked this Al Ahli hospital. But, you know, forensic evidence is very clear. There was Israeli bombing from the air on that hospital. But even, okay, assuming that this was an excuse for one hospital, what about the 36 hospitals and clinics that were targeted intentionally by airplanes afterwards, leaving the Gaza healthcare system non-existent, basically. And so now, with 73 or 75,000, I think the last number, injured Gazans pulled from the rubble or shrapnel or things like that, you know, a lot of them will die. Estimates are between 30 to 40 some percent will die because of lack of medical facilities. But Israel is also not just targeting hospitals, targeting cultural centers, mosques. Over 200 mosques and three churches were destroyed. Targeting universities. These are just some universities that were targeted. You can see the picture on the upper right-hand corner before and below it, the picture after. This is Al-Quds Open University, etc. The people of Gaza are, of course, resilient and try to do their best, but this is an ongoing genocide. Even as I speak to you, there are people being killed. The people of the, you know, first responders, I really sympathize with them. Many of them were killed. The picture on the left is a group of first responders proud of saving a child. This is in the beginning, in the first 2 weeks of the onslaught on Gaza. Now you won't see them smiling like this about one baby that they saved, because they are barely catching up, and half those people in the picture you see on the left side are already gone themselves, killed themselves. This is an ongoing thing, as I said, from 1948. Attacks on the press, for example, is also is more than 10% or 15% of the journalists in Gaza were killed. That's higher percentage than, of course, number of regular people killed, civilians. And or injured or arrested, like this two husband and wife journalists who we still don't know where they are. By the way, was kidnapped by the Israeli soldiers. Israel kidnapped thousands of Palestinians, both in the West Bank and Gaza. So people try to survive, try to manage, even try to have fun. This is a photographer, you know, that I discovered was taking a lot of nice photographs. He was so proud. This picture, when he and a few kids found the tent, finally got a tent donated so they don't have to live under the rain and cold weather. This is in an UNRWA school where people are all over each other in the classrooms and in the yard of the school. These are some pictures that that same person, Thabit, took in the refugee camps, in the tent camps, and what they are living and how they are living. He has amazing photographs. This is also his photograph of basically some two people entertaining the kids as clowns. So, bottom line is, what do we want? What we want is an end to this nightmare immediately, of course. And you guys have been calling for ceasefire, and around the world have been calling for ceasefire, hundreds of millions of people. But we call more than for a ceasefire. We call to the end of the world's largest concentration camp. We call for the removal of every colonial settler in the West Bank. We call for the right of return. We call for a just resolution to the governance of the lands of Israel and Palestine. We call for prosecution of war crimes, for ethnic cleansing, taking land by war, transfer of population, collective management, etc. The people are with us, the Western people are with us, because the Zionist lobby cannot go around and buy hundreds of millions of people. They can buy politicians, they can buy the media, they can bribe politicians like Edelstein, or what's his name, who was bribing politicians by photographing them or videotaping them with children and with underage girls having sex. And so the Zionist movement has videos on most politicians in the world, including, in my humble opinion, both Trump and Biden. That's why both are Zionists. Not because they bribe them with money, because they blackmail them with videotapes. So that's why you see, for example, this is from the Greek capital, where you see the Israeli flag on the Greek, parliament. And then in the front of the same parliament, the Greek people coming out to demonstrate for Palestine. This is in London, hundreds of thousands in Yemen, millions of people in all Yemen cities, basically Jews of conscience, religious Jews, secular Jews have stood up and said the problem is Zionism and it's time for us to get this changed and we can expand our boycott, divestment, sanctions. Now I want to just say a few words about, you know, of course, you know about our museum and what it does, but I do want to, this is what the museum looks like. This is some of our situation in the West Bank. I just want to say a few words about that. The picture on the upper right is of Bethlehem, Christmas the year before and Christmas this past Christmas below it. Obviously, we didn't have tourists, we didn't have local tourists even, Bethlehem was locked up, just like most Palestinian cities was locked up. So we had a horrible situation in Bethlehem. There are so many needy people in Bethlehem because there's high unemployment now, some 60-70% unemployment now. Which is three times what it used to be in the Great Depression in the U.S., by the way. Anyways, this is Christmas. We put even rubble in front of the Church of Nativity because Jesus, as you know, the Herod killed the babies in Bethlehem to try and get to Jesus. So we even had an incubator with a model of Jesus inside it in front of the Church of Nativity. But of course, as I said, not many people were there, and the situation was really bad. This I like this picture. I don't know who made it, who put them together, but this is Mother Mary and Jesus, and then a woman from Gaza and her child. So those two brother and sister looking up to the sky, for bombs or whatever, or for salvation or hope. I don't think it's going to come from above or from below other than death and destruction. And I will end by reiterating why I said in the beginning that we have, or the title of the lecture also, is that genocide here is different. And it's different in that it has global ramifications. It's now, I don't know if you heard, just 10 days ago there were, or a few days ago, there were maneuvers of Russian Navy with Chinese Navy with Iranian Navy in the in several oceans, and this was expected. The U.S. of course conducts its own naval exercises with its allies, including Israel and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, etc. We are starting a regional war already, and it's going to spread to a global war. I wish I could tell you the chance of that is small. It could be as much as 60-70%. That's going to be horrible for everybody. If I say 60 or 70%, what's the other 30 or 40%? You know, when Dean said I'm prophetic, you don't have to be prophetic to, if you study history, you see what's going on. The other option, option two, if you want, the 30 or 40%, I mentioned it at the first time I spoke at the community church in Boston, maybe 20 some years ago or more. When I said, you know, we have those two roads to go. We can either go down the road of win-win and have livable planets and be fair to everybody and share the resources on this planet. That's one option. Or we can continue down the option we were going before. But unlike before, by the way, now it's the end of the road. Basically, the lemmings have reached the cliff. And when we reach a cliff, it's the end of it for all of us, whether we're black lemmings or white lemmings or or Zionist lemmings or non-Zionist, anti-Zionist lemmings. We're going to go down the drain, all of us. That choice is still there. Some of us work to avoid that choice, to avoid that dreaded, you know, right-wing ideas that are taking us to this global war. Or we can sober up and get serious about changing the course. It's not going to be easy. And as I said, I wish I could say we will succeed. As a scientist, I say probability that we will succeed is 40% at best. So I'll stop here, and I'm happy to take any questions or comments you have.
You have been listening to Bethlehem University Professor Mazum Kumsia speaking at the Community Church of Boston. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. This Week in Palestine is also broadcast every Monday morning in Round Mountain, California, at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, which you can access online at kkrn.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.